first thing I want to do today, I don't spend too long over, will be an informal, but not too informal, demonstration that the clique problem, the problem, you're given a graph with n vertices, does it contain a clique with m vertices, is m clique complete. I remember last time I gave you what I described as a trivial example of an n clique complete problem. That's the problem, you're given a binary circuit. Does there exist some choice of zeros and ones for the input that gives you a 1 as the output? And that's sort of trivially NP complete because you can just make your circuit calculate any other Boolean function that is polynomial time computable. And so then the question just more or less becomes, is there an input for that Boolean function that gives you a 1? So anything that you want, you translate it into that. So my task now, effectively, is the following. I want to take a circuit, and I want to build a graph such that the graph has a clique of size m, if and only if there is some choice of inputs for the circuit that gives a 1. I suppose I can let me just write that, just hold this in one's head. So I'm given a circuit. Let's call that C or something. I want a graph G such that G contains Km if and only circuit has some choice inputs. If I can do that, then I've shown. Well, if I can do that, subject to obvious constraints such as I want the construction to be something I can obviously do in polynomial time. I want the graph not to be massively bigger than the circuit. So the size of the graph will be comparable to the size of the circuit, etc. So why does this do the job for me? Because then, if I've got any NP complete problem, first I devise a circuit such that that given NP complete problem has answer yes if and only if there are some inputs that give me 1. Then I construct a graph that contains a clique if and only if the circuit has those inputs. And then if I've got some black box that tells me whether the graph has got a clique, then it has therefore told me whether the original NP problem had answer yes. So how do we do this? So let's start with the circuit. So this is going to be informal. I won't write down exactly what I'm doing. I'll just tell you what I'm doing. Let's take a rather simple circuit just to draw, but the argument will apply to any circuit. Let's suppose I had an AND gate here, an AND gate here, an OR gate there or something. Now, how am I going to build a graph out of it? Well, the graph has to have the property that a clique in the graph corresponds in some way to a choice of inputs. So what I want to do is to choose the graph in such a way that if I've got some subset of vertices of a given size, and they're all joined to each other, it somehow forces me to make some declaration of whether I'm going to choose a 0 or a 1 here, a 0 or a 1 here, a 0 or a 1 here, a 0 or a 1 here. Now, just leaving aside all other properties that the graph should have, but I'm giving you this spiel rather than just presenting you with the graph, because I want to try to convey the fact that NP completeness proofs, a lot of them are reasonably natural and easy. So this is the sort of rough thought process that goes behind it. I think there have been some examples where people have really had to struggle to prove that something is NP complete and then managed. But by and large, I think it's usually sort of a little bit of ingenuity is needed, but not too much. Once you've done a few, you sort of get the idea. So what would possibly force us to choose between noughts and ones? Well, I could just take each input vertex replace it, and put two vertices in my graph. Actually, let me just arrange them horizontally rather than So I'll have some pairs of vertices in the graph. And I'll just for my own convenience, it's not part of the construction of the graph, I'll label them 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. Now, if later on I can somehow insist that I must choose at least four of these eight vertices in my clique, and if I don't join this vertex to this vertex, and I don't join this vertex to this vertex, and so on, then I'm going to have to choose precisely one of this north and this one, and precisely one of this north and this one, and so on. So it's very simple. I just replace the vertex at the top there by a pair of vertices. I'm not saying anything about whether these... in fact, I am implicitly saying something. Implicitly, I'm saying that all the vertices that do not belong to the same pair are going to have to be joined to each other. Otherwise, there's no way I could choose one from each pair. See what I mean? So far I have specified some of the graph. I'm going to say that, but I won't draw all these intersections. It'll get horribly messy. But let's just say within each pair they're not joined, and within different pairs they are joined. And later on we'll see that we've got to choose four vertices from up here, so we've got to choose precisely one from each pair, and therefore I've got to choose something that's going to correspond in some way to a choice of inputs. All right, now let's see how we can realize this AND gate here. So, let's first of all do something obvious, but it doesn't work. So, I have a 0 and a 1. What I want to do is say that I want to do something that's going to make it force me to choose this 0 if I choose 0 and 0, because the AND of 0 and 0 is 0. So, the main thing I have to ensure in order to do that is that this is 1. Well, first of all, as usual, I will make sure that I have to choose at least one of these two vertices. If this 1 is not joined to both this 0 and this 0, then I'll have to choose the 0. So, in order to, but also, I would also, in order to be able to choose the 0, I have to make this 0 join to both that 0 and that 0. So, what about 0 and 1? Well, 0 and 1 would have to be joined to 0 for the same sort of reason. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to choose this 0 if I chose this 0 and this 1. So I do that. And 1 and 0 would have to be joined to 0. And then 1 and 1 would have to be joined to 1. And what have I got? I've got something that doesn't work because... Why doesn't it work? Yes, because if I choose 1 and 1, they're also joined to 0. So 1 and 1 wasn't forcing me to choose 1. So the very first thing you write down doesn't work, but the second thing you write down does work. So here's the second thing. We don't have two vertices down here, we just have four vertices. So this one will be the 0-0 vertex. This one will be the 0-1 vertex. This one will be the 1-0 vertex. And this one will be the 1-1 vertex. And I'll label these 0 because the AND of 2-0 is 0. 1 because a 0 and a 1, sorry, 0 I mean, because a 0 and a 1 gives me a 0. 0 because a 1 and a 0 gives me a 0. And a 1 because 1 and 1 gives 1. And let's do precisely the same here. I had an AND gate there, so let's quickly do the same thing. 0, 0, 0, 1. So this 0 is going to 2 0s. 0 joined to 0, 1. 0 joined to 1, 0. And 1 joined to 1, 1. Now, I just have a faint feeling of anxiety at this point that if what happens if we need 8 vertices down here or something, or 16 or something. But actually, you don't, thank goodness. So let's just see why not. So let's just get an OR gate down here. Turns out that four vertices is still enough. Because it's an OR gate, I'm going to turn out to be labeled 0, 1, 1, 1. And the idea is I'll join 0 to all 0s here and all 0s here. the OR of two noughts is a north. This one will be the naught one vertex. And this one will be the one naught vertex. And this one will be the one one vertex. Let's have a little look at that. Perhaps it'll help if I just put some blobs around here just to show how I'm partitioning the vertex set. So if I do this, we can have the convention that all other edges are in, so to speak. So if I take any two of these sets, then if I haven't already drawn some edges between them, then all edges should be in. Now let's look at, in this graph, so for example, just to say, this has no edges joined over here, so the convention is that all the edges from here to here are in the graph. So now let's look for a clique of size 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I want a clique of size 7. So I can't choose more than two vertices in any of these cells of the partitions. I've got to choose precisely one vertex in each cell. So I've got to choose a vertex labeled 0 or 1, 0 or 1, 0 or 1, 0 or 1. If, say, I choose a 0 here and a 1 here, the only vertex that's joined to both that 0 and that 1 is this 0 here. So I've got to, if I choose this 0 and this 1, I'm going to have to choose this 0. And say if I choose 1 and 1, I'm going to have to choose this 1. But if I choose this 0 and this 1, I have got to choose this 1 down here. And then the final thing I do, that's so I've somehow sort of mimicked the circuit, but we also wanted it to produce a 1, if and only if the circuit produced a 1. So at that stage, I'll just get rid of this naught here. So if I just cross out this and all the edges that are connected to it, then the only way of getting a clique is if I choose the appropriate noughts and 1s up here in such a way that the vertex that I'm forced to choose down here was a 1. And actually, I haven't done not gates, but those are very simple. So if I've got, say I had 1 and 4, I had 0, 0, 0, 1, then obviously I could just join a 0 to the 1 and a 1 to the 3 noughts, and that would give me a way of producing a not gate as well. So I'll just say that once again. You duplicate the input vertices. Every time you've got an AND gate, you produce 4 vertices, you join them, and you join them to all possible pairs, one from here, and you label them 0 or 1 according to whether the circuit would have given you a 0 or a 1. And you keep going with that process. You join all the other edges that you haven't talked about yet, and then a clique has to choose precisely one from each cell of the partition. And once you've chosen which ones you get from the top, all the rest is forced in precisely the same way that a circuit does its job with AND and OR gates and NOT gates. And then you get rid of the NOT in the very bottom that corresponds to the output. There might be 3 NOTs, in which case you get rid of all those. And then you're done. And you've got a graph that contains a clique of size m. And whatever do you choose, m turns out to be precisely the number of vertices in the circuit, because we have one of these little collections of vertices for each vertex in the circuit. Okay, so that's the sort of informal demonstration that the clique problem is NP-complete, which I wanted to give because I'm going to be talking a lot about the clique problem and its monotone circuit complexity. Now it's a fully motivated thing to think about because now know that if you had a polynomial time algorithm for finding cliques, then you'd have a polynomial time algorithm for everything, and p would equal np. And actually, I suppose from the other direction, actually, come to think of it, it is worth knowing, but strictly speaking, you could say it doesn't motivate looking at the monotone circuit complexity of the clique problem, because if one could get a lower bound for the circuit complexity of the clique problem, then that would already show that P didn't equal NP, because you have an NP problem with no polynomial time algorithm. Nevertheless, it's sort of useful to know that the clique problem is known to be one of the hardest problems in NP, so it's a good candidate to look at if you're trying to find lower bounds. Perhaps that's the best way of thinking about it. So let's turn to the question of proving lower bounds for circuit complexity. And I am going to sort of ramble on informally a bit more, but we're getting to the stage, of course, where I will start writing demos and theorems and giving proper proofs. So, but before I do that, I just want to think. I want to try to explain why it's hard to prove that functions, just in a very simple-minded way, why it's hard to prove that lower bounds on circuit complexity. There are, in fact, extremely unsimple-minded reasons for it being hard, and I will touch on those a bit later on in the course. But I just want to sort of... What I'm going to do is I'm going to look at a very naive definition of complexity and show why it doesn't really help at all. Incidentally, another thing to say is that the next section of the course, I've decided to break with my usual practice and actually write out or sort of write some printed sort of account of the next bit of the course, including the proof of the lower bound of monotone circuit complexity. I'm not sure whether I'll actually photocopy it and hand it out. I think it might be better just to put it on my webpage, unless enough people think they're going to print it out, that I sort of, it's better for the environment to photocopy some things than it is for everybody separately to print it on later. We'll think about that. I hope it's not yet ready. I've started it, but it's not yet ready. So let's just, what would be a strategy for proving a lower bound for circuit complexity? We'd start with some, let's concentrate on the clique problem, because that's what I'm going to be talking about. So let's define, I'll say m equals m choose 2, and I'll let gamma be a set of graphs G such that the vertex set of G is a set of 1 to m, and G contains G of size. Now we can think of gamma in an obvious way . So that's gamma MR, I mean. So we can think of, let's call it gamma equals gamma MR. So we can think of gamma as a subset of 0, 1 to n. So what we've whether I need to spell this out. Perhaps I will. So, phi bijection from pairs of vertices to 1 to n, and G associated we look at all the edges of G and we take five of those edges, and so five each edge will be a, so that's going to be a subset of 1 to n, and then we convert the subset of 1 to n to 0, 1 sequence by taking the characteristic function. So, given a graph, the edges I, the potential edges I associate with numbers 1 to n, and I put a 0 if that edge is in and a 1 if it's not. Although the other way around, sorry, a 0 if that edge is not in and a 1 if it is. Anyway, so I wanted to say that once. Sometimes it's convenient to talk about 0, 1 sequences, sometimes it's convenient to talk about gamma as being a set of graphs. I shall just pass completely freely between the two, and I will not mention phi and things like that, I'll just completely identify them. So gamma is a bunch of Boolean sequences, it's also a bunch of graphs. Right. So what are we trying to do? Well, just remember that straight line model of computation that we were talking about before. We started with sets E1, E2 up to EN. Those were half spaces, so EI was the set of all X such that XI equaled 1. And then we continued the sequence, EN plus 1 up to some EM, and each of these ones was either the complement of an earlier one or the union of two earlier ones or the intersection of two earlier ones. So far I'm just talking about general circuit complexity and not just monotone circuit complexity. What sort of conceivable way might we have of proving that EM cannot equal gamma unless M is extremely large? That's what one would need to do to prove that P didn't equal NP. Well, a very natural strategy would be the following. E1 up to EN are extremely simple sets. They're just half spaces. Whether or not you're in the set depends on just one coordinate of your Boolean sequence. So you might sort of hope that you can come up with a definition of complexity and say that should have the following properties. E1 up to EN are incredibly simple according to this definition of complexity. Whenever you take a union of two sets of low complexity, you get a set of low complexity, and similarly with intersections and complements. But gamma has incredibly high complexity. And then you somehow prove by induction that the sets all the way along here have low complexity because each one is a union, intersection, or complement of earlier sets with low complexity. And so you just build up, and you try to prove that the complexity builds up too slowly for you to be able to produce gamma. I think that it's not just a natural strategy, it's just the first strategy that anyone would think of for proving something like this. Let's start with the first complexity definition that anyone would think of and show why it fails miserably. So, I've already hinted at it, that whether or not you belong to EI depends on just one coordinate of your sequence. Depends on xi. If xi is 1, you're in, and if xi is 0, you're not in. What about, say, E1 intersect E2? Well, whether or not you're in E1 intersect E2 depends just on the first and second coordinates. So you could, a definition starts to suggest itself. Perhaps we could define the complexity of a set to be the number of coordinates that you have to specify before you know whether or not you're in the set. And as a matter of fact, this definition is not, it is useful for some things, but not for proving that P doesn't equal NP. I'm going to do one thing that's very stupid, and then I'll do something else that's marginally less stupid, but still fails miserably. So the very stupid thing to do would be to say, well, the complexity, I'm defining kappa of A to be number of coordinates, you must specify of x to determine whether x belongs to A. So kappa of each EI is 1, and it's obvious that kappa of A intersect B is less than or equal to kappa of A plus kappa of B, because once you specify the coordinates you need to know for whether you're in A, and you specify the ones you need to know for whether you're in B, then you know whether you're in A intersect B. And similarly for kappa A union B, and we also get that kappa of A equals kappa of A. So, if we do that, what could we say by induction? Well, En plus 1 will have complexity at least 2, and in general, you could argue that by induction that... complexity of En plus 1, this is not what I was going to do, I was going to do something even worse than this, but let's be a bit more sensible. So what would be the worst possible complexity of En plus 2? It would be at worst the biggest two complexities you've got so far. So 3, and then the complexity of En plus 3, at most the sum of the two things you've got, 4, 5, you get the Fibonacci numbers. I was going to get powers of 2, but I just realised that just small improvements possible. It seems to be blowing up exponentially. Trivially, the complexity of any set is at most n, because if you know all the coordinates of a point, you know whether it belongs to a set. So this particular approach cannot get you more than n plus log n along this sequence, which is very, very disappointing. However, I have done something rather stupid, and you can see it already here. What's the worst possible complexity of En plus 3? Well, could we actually get 5? Let's just think about that. If En plus 1 was, say, supposing En plus 1, the set of things you need to specify was 1, the singleton 1, 1 and 2, because En plus 1 was E1 intersect E2 or something like that. Suppose En plus 2, how could we get 3 things? Well, maybe En plus 2, the coordinates you need to specify, 1, 2, 3. Then what coordinates could you possibly need to specify for n plus 3 if you built it out of En plus 1 and En plus 2? Still only 1, 2, 3. So you couldn't, in fact, you cannot get 5 here. It's rather easy to see it. You can't possibly get 5. If you're quite careful about it, and this I've written up but won't give today, you can get a bound something like En plus I has complexity at most I plus 1. But let me just give you a quick argument. It's at most 2i, but that's enough to illustrate an important aspect of a later proof. So the inductive hypothesis that I was implicitly using here was just a sort of numerical one, the complexity of the set En plus k. Let me just write it out. I was using complexity En plus k is at most a Fibonacci number, or the kth Fibonacci number, or k plus first, or something like that. But if instead of a numerical inductive hypothesis, you go for a sort of what you might call a set theoretic inductive hypothesis, you do something about the set. Here's a better inductive hypothesis. There is a set, which I call it B, of size at most 2k. Membership of En plus 1, En plus k is determined by the coordinates in B. So all these sets, you know whether you belong to them if you know all the coordinates from B. Now let's just see why we can get, supposing I now look at En plus K plus 1, what could it be? It could either be one of the half spaces intersect one of these things, or it could be one of the half spaces union one of these things, or a complement of something before, or it could be two of those union each other, or it could be two of the half spaces union each other, or something like that. Now, if I involve one of these sets, then whether or not I belong to that set still only depends on the coordinates in B. So the only way I can introduce new coordinates is if I use a half space. How many half spaces can I possibly involve in the definition of En plus K plus 1, at most 2? The number of new coordinates that can possibly be involved at the next stage is at most 2 more. So we get 2K plus 2. So to put that another way, take the set En plus K plus 1. It will be either a complement or a union or intersection of some earlier sets. Of those sets, take the ones that come from here. So we get maybe an EI and possibly an EJ. We get at most 2 coordinates involved from E1 up to EN. And so supposing the coordinates that are involved are I and J, then the set B, so I call it BK, then BK plus 1 is a subset of BK union IJ, or that might just be a singleton or might be empty. As I say, even that is a weaker argument than it needs to be, and you can get, with a bit more thought, you can get K plus 1. But the point is that even if you get K plus 1, you haven't really proved anything terribly interesting. You've only proved that the size of the circuit, or beyond the original inputs, must be at most n minus 1 or something like that. And in fact, here's an even more compelling reason why this proof had no chance of working. And it's that if you look at the parity function, that's the function that's 1 if you've got an odd number of 1s and 0 if you've got an even number of 1s, depends on every single coordinate. If I know n minus 1 of the coordinates, I still don't know whether I've got an odd number of 1s or an even number of 1s. It will depend critically on the last one that I haven't specified. So according to this definition, the parity function has complexity n, but it's easy to find polynomial time algorithms for the parity function. So it was sort of doomed from the start, but it's somehow worth seeing why it was doomed. But the thing I want to stress from all that, well, there are two things. One is, if you now went away and said, well, okay, that was just the first thing to try, let's try and be a bit more clever, you just seem to find that every single thing you try, every single modification of it, always seems to blow up to the point where you can't prove a bound that's better than n. And I should just say that the best known lower bound for the circuit complexity of any Boolean function with n inputs that belongs to np is 3n. So actually, I don't know, I have never actually looked up that result. I don't see how to do better than n. But 3n is the record, I think. And before Rasbrov came along, the best known bound for monotone circuit complexity, i.e. where you're not allowed to, it's a monotone function, and you're not allowed to use complements, and a huge improvement on that, it was 4n. But that situation has now changed. But the second thing I wanted to stress was this point that when you are defining a complexity definition, then the sort of inductive hypothesis that you're better off taking is one that's somehow connected with a set rather than with just a number. So if you're trying to define your complexity to be some numerical parameter associated with a set, then that seems to be a bad strategy, whereas if you define it to be some set associated with a set, do induction on that set and then say, aha, but then now we've got a set that can't be too big or something like that. So you only put in numbers right near the end. That seems to be a much better strategy. So let me now then talk in rather general terms about a method that Razborov introduced. Now, we'll have to refine it a little bit in order to make it work. So this is the method of approximation. I'm going to continue to talk as though we were trying to prove that P didn't equal NP rather than monotone circuit complexity. So what I'm going to say is still a doomed strategy until one refines it very slightly. But this is a very beautiful idea that Razborov had. Recall that we're trying to find some notion of simplicity or equivalently complexity. We're trying to find some notion of low complexity and argue that as you build up sets using intersections and unions, the complexity doesn't blow up too fast, and the set we're trying to build has high complexity. So he suggested the following. We take take a collection L of subsets of the Boolean cube, and so the idea to have in the back of one's mind is that L consists only of simple sets. So the sets in L are somehow simple, and define operations extend what I'm talking about and have some. This is, we can think of that as a sort of pseudo intersection, pseudo union, and we could have a pseudo complement as well if we were trying to go for arbitrary circuit complexity rather than just monotone. In the paper, I think it's standardly, this is known as the meet and the join. Well, I'll call them that, the meet and the join. And so these are binary operations defined on L. And a couple of basic properties that L should have. We want L to contain all the half spaces, and we also want it to contain the empty set and the whole of the Boolean cube. And we also want it to be closed under these funny operations. We haven't yet decided what these funny operations will be at all. Now, what we do want is that they should somehow approximate intersection and union. And so, anyway. I'm really not assuming very much about the meet and join. I'm not sort of assuming that the meet is associated with one another. But actually, not quite clear in my mind about what precisely is needed to be assumed. The ones that we're actually going to choose will have various obvious nice properties like being associated and stuff. So let's just, but I don't think it probably won't be the case, for example, that this distributes over this or something like that. That's not part of the assumption. So we'll just see. We'll be operating sort of concretely rather than abstractly in the proofs. So we call this structure a legitimate lattice. And what is the basic strategy here? It's to start with a circuit, E1, EM. And so again, this is what I mean by, when I say circuit, I mean the sort of sets corresponding to a circuit in the usual sense. So each EI is union, intersectional, early one. And then we construct a sort of parallel sequence of sets, which are called F1. And how do we build the FIs? Well, F1 to FN. Are just the EIs, which we know we can do because L contain. So these belong to L. We've got a computation that just takes place in the normal world of all subsets of 0, 1 to the L. We've got some parallel computation that takes place entirely in L. Well, it's a very obvious thing to do, and that's exactly what we do do. So if if ER equals ES union ET, then FR equals FS join FT, and similarly for the meets. So in other words, the F sequence does exactly what the E sequence does, except it replaces unions and intersections by joins and meets. Now, if we've managed to devise the operations here in order to approximate reasonably well intersections and unions, then in some sense, the set EM and FM, the sets EM and FM will be close if M is small. And if, in addition, we can devise it so that all the sets in L are fairly simple, and the set gamma MR, the set that we're trying to produce as our EM is not simple, and it's not even close to simple, then we have a proof. So that's the rough idea. The rough idea is, because of this, we know that EM is close to FM. FM is very simple. Gamma MR is not at all simple. In fact, it's not even close to a simple set. And therefore, EM can't be gamma R when M is small. That's the sort of basic strategy. But it does leave unanswered one huge question, which is how on earth to define these operations. But that's going to be a task for the next lecture. In this lecture, I want to I think I've got about time to do this. Dilemma about what to say at this point. There is an extra property that the particular definition that Radbrov came up with has that's very helpful. I'm wondering whether to. I think I'm going to take the slightly shorter view. And then in the notes that I've been writing, I've gone and taken a rather roundabout route of sort of saying, well, trying to sort of build up to it, because what he does looks so sort of extraordinary that you can be left with the feeling. And I still am, largely, sort of, how on earth did anyone ever think of this? So I've tried to write something that's a bit sort of long and rambling and tries various things that don't work quite so well, and then sort of refine it until you actually get up with the definition. But there are still some unjustified leaps that I hope maybe to do something about. But, so let me just say, without any real justification, but I will justify it in retrospect, that we will also have the property that the definition that he comes up with, come to think of it, this is not totally essential, but okay, so I needn't have made this remark, it suddenly occurs to me, but the definition will turn out to have the property that A meets B is a subset of A intersection B, and A join B is a superset of A union B. Now, I want to think about in what sense EM and FM are going to be close if we do this process. To answer that, actually what I'm doing here is giving a proof and then we work out what the statement is afterwards. So the proof is, let's look at EM with FM removed, but everything in EM is not in FM. So if EM equals ER union ES, let's say, then FM equals FR join FS. So EM minus FM equals and now we do a kind of, I think of this as a set theoretic version of adding and subtracting the same thing. So we get ER union ES minus FR union FS. Well, two epsilon argument, but it's sets rather than numbers. Union FR union FS minus FR meet FS. Join them. And that's contained in if you want to be in ER union ES but not in FR union FS, you're not allowed to be in FR and you're not allowed to be in FFS. So if you're in ER, then you must be in ER without FR, and if you're in ES, you must be in ES and not FS. And that justifies what I'm about to write down here. ER take away FR union ES. Take away FS. So just once again, if X is in ER, then it's in this, and if X is in ES, then it must be in this. Union. Well, FR union FS, take away FR, join FFS. If we, I am using it actually, yeah. So if we've got this property up here, that the join actually contains the union, then this is empty. Let me do another similar calculation for the case where I've lost the original case. But anyway, if EM equals EI intersect ES. Yes. Then exactly the same general idea contained in and this lot here is also contained in ER take away FR. And a slight rush, so I won't justify this, but it's as simple as it was the previous time. Union. Now, what about this set here? We don't really know about this. We know that FR intersect FS does contain FR meet FS. So, if we don't know about it, let's just give it a name. We'll call it delta meet FR, FS. And The point here is that this sort of tells us that if we can devise the meat in such a way that the meat of any two sets is not too much smaller than the intersection of those two sets when they belong to L, then we can think of delta FR F of S as being a sort of small error set. So this is a sort of... small error. And what I've just given you is a proof of, maybe at the beginning of next time, because I unfortunately the timing hasn't worked out very well, I will do the other cases, which I might just have left because they were similar, before it gets back into the swing of this. So, by induction, write down what we end up doing. There is a union I equals 1 to m, m minus n actually, delta ai vi. AI and BI belong to this set L, such that BN plus 1 minus FN plus 1 EM minus FN R, let's call it U, all subsets of UM. So the idea is that ER minus FR and ES minus F of S are already subsets of UM minus 1, and in order to get myself this entire set here, I just had to add in one extra error set. So I've now got a union of M error sets instead of M minus 1 error sets. So, in what I'm going to hand out on the web page, this will be written a bit more formally, and but I'm sort of proving it backwards because I want to emphasize somehow that the proof was generated by the tool generates itself, whereas I could have just slapped down an inductive open concept and proved it. But maybe at the beginning of next time I will do it the other way around. So I'll do the corresponding statement for FM takeaway EM in terms of some union-y error sets. And maybe that I'll do that in a way that may be more palatable to some people. And just say what the inductive hypothesis is and prove it. And then we will get on to the tricky business of actually saying what the matter is.